Welcome to the Science and Cocktails podcast.
Get on your spaceship.
Interesting.
And now the machine is working.
Increase the frequency of lucid dreams in our laboratories.
Over time, the variation within a group becomes variation between groups.
It has to do with particles or objects and how they move.
Am I true? Am I awake?
We think that there is a kind of God against it.
What are the processes behind?
It's a piece of stuff.
We are moving in space-time. Go like 1 second per second, flowing up in the fourth dimension.
This episode is about clustered, regularly, interspaced, short, palindromic repeats, also known as CRISPR, which is an immune system found in bacteria and archaea, which defends the organisms against viruses.
So CRISPR is just a repeated DNA sequence, and between the repeated sequence, there are short fragments of DNA that are derived from viruses that infect these microorganisms.
This is Su Ping, who is an associate professor in functional genomics at the University of Copenhagen.
So the microorganism will take a piece of DNA from the infecting viruses and then store it as a memory into its own genome. When it is expressed, it will have the ability to recognize viruses having this sequence. So it's sort of memorized immunity. And that's why it's also called adaptive immunity in bacteria and archaea. So I take this sequence, I put in my memory bank, and then when I meet this sequence again, by the sequence similarity, I know, okay, I have seen this before, I know this is the enemy, and now I need to destroy it.
Why did nature develop this mechanism?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. I think nature developed many different immune systems, both for us, I mean for other animals, for plants, for bacteria, for archaea. There is always competition between different species. There is fight. There's also harmony, but there is fight. So this system is used, different immune systems are used by different organisms to fight against invaders. This mechanism has helped bacteria and archaea to survive virus infection.
CRISPR-Cas systems is immune systems found in bacteria and archaea, which has helped the organisms to survive. But the ability CRISPR has to cut out genes of a genome is an ideal tool for gene manipulation. And bioengineering is developing fast in finding new ways to use the technique to cure diseases like cancer and genetic diseases. But at the same time, the technology can be used in changing unborn babies' DNA and potentially constructing the perfect human beings.
These are the sounds of the brave new world, of test tube and decanter, of hissing injectors and gurgling blood substitute. We are inside the London Hatchery and Conditioning Centre, and this is the fertilizing room, an enormous laboratory where the temperature is never allowed to fall below 98.6. And here comes the director of hatcheries and conditioning in person, bringing with him a group
Tomorrow,
of young students.
Tomorrow you'll be settling down to serious work. Today I just want to give you a general idea of things. These are the incubators, and here is the week's supply of ova, kept at blood heat. Come along, boys. Now here, we immerse the eggs into a warm bouillon containing free-swimming spermatozoa. Immersion continues until the eggs are all fertilized. Ah, and over here, here is where we bottle the alphas and betas. In short, gentlemen, the perfect process for manufacturing healthy babies.
This is from the novel The Brave New World, written by Aldous Huxley in 1931. It's a horrifying science fiction presenting a future with perfect manufactured babies created in tubes in different casts. Though the scenario is still far away from our reality, his predictions of the future might not be so wrong. In 2018, the first gene-manipulated babies were born in a lab in China. The Chinese scientist He Changkui shocked the world by claiming he had made the first gene-edited babies. His aim was to make the babies resistant to HIV. It's said that he did target the correct gene, but he had not created the exact mutation associated with resistance to HIV. Instead, he created previously unseen genetic edits, and the effects of those are currently unknown. He Changkui is now in jail. His work has never been published, and the long-term effects the baby will suffer and might pass on to future generations is still unknown. Though CRISPR is a famous tool for gene manipulation, there's a lot more to it. In this episode, we'll meet a number of scientists who will expand the perspectives on what CRISPR is and how it can be applied. And I will warn you, it is some geeky stuff. We'll start with what CRISPR is and how it was discovered, going to how it can be used in gene therapy in humans, and which ethical dilemmas are involved. And from there, we will dive into how else CRISPR is interesting for biomedicine, expanding the understanding of different kinds of CRISPRs, which is a result of a billion years of evolution. And this is where it becomes really geeky and beautiful, and giving an understanding of how genius nature is and how we're speeding up the evolution by using those mechanisms that took other creatures so long to evolve in new ways for the benefit of our own species. We'll start from the beginning by meeting Roger Garrett, who is now a professor emeritus at the University of Copenhagen. He's been on board ever since CRISPR was first discovered.
We saw these CRISPRs in the late 90s when we were sequencing genomes. And we knew that they were important, and we talked about it a lot internally in the lab about what they could be doing and why they were so extensive. We noticed very early on that some of them match viruses, because we've been sequencing viruses from this organism. And we just thought it was chance. We didn't really catch on to the idea it was some sort of defense mechanism, unfortunately. And then it was another 6 years before Mojica, the Spanish guy, actually presented the data the first time. And then we said, oh. And then we published our work just after him.
So what were some of the first ideas when you first found the mechanism? What did you think it was?
Well, I think people mentioned it, you know, there are virus sequences and maybe it's something to do with viruses. But at that time we were focusing on finishing the genome, which was very difficult. So that was the main obsession, and we had this repeat thing on the side that we talk about over a cup of coffee when we relaxed and so on.
So Roger Garrett and his colleagues did see these CRISPR repeats in the archaea genomes. But at that time, they were busy sequencing the first genome.
But then it became a major obsession once we finished the sequencing. And at that point, around 2005, a lot of labs started moving in slowly. And it wasn't surprising to us at that time, because biochemistry had become really boring. I mean, there was very little going on. Very little exciting. I mean, it was all just repeating things with another organism.
In a boring time in biochemistry, suddenly something exciting happens. And CRISPR was seen in many different variations, and everyone was very excited.
And the progress was very rapid over the next five, until today. still very rapid. Around 2013, we had international meetings from 2005 onwards, once we knew it was an immune system. And then it was just a small group of people, a small group of labs that were participating and congratulating each other on their exciting work and so on. And it was very, very friendly, you know, it wasn't competitive because it was, there weren't many groups, so it was just people who knew each other and worked together and talked, shared data and so on. But then the big groups started moving in, especially the big American groups who hadn't been involved before, but they saw the potential, commercial potential.
And what kind of commercial potential did they see back then?
Well, they saw gene therapy, gene modifications. That was the main point, that you could cut the genome very precisely, at least in theory. And so you could cut at any point in the gene, or you could cut, excise a gene, or you could remove part of a gene and replace it. I mean, all these basic functions were suddenly possible because you could cut specifically in the genome.
So the field was divided in two different groups. The scientists who did the basic research on CRISPR-Cas systems, and the more application-oriented groups who are searching for ways to use CRISPR for gene editing to cure diseases.
So for around 2013, there was a meeting. This was sort of soon before I started retiring. And I didn't go to it, but I was still working then. And the people from the lab who went there said it was just a crazy meeting, because there were all the people who wanted to do gene therapy, and there were the people who were interested in the mechanisms of the CRISPR systems. And they didn't talk to each other. You know, gene manipulators just wanted the latest details on the specificity of cutting and which were the best enzymes to use for their work. So then it diverged, and I stayed with the basic CRISPR stuff. So I didn't really follow all the developments. But I read recently in a review, and it was incredible how much work has been done in modifying genes, deleting genes, exchanging genes, adding genes that function differently from the one that was there before. And what is a bit disturbing for me is the ethics of this. I mean, you could say, okay, if somebody has, or an organism has a defective gene, if you replace it, then the organism will become more healthy. That I can sort of live with, you know, but I sense from the review that some people are just saying, well, okay, we have this operon that does this. If we change one of the genes in the operon that does something different, could the operon then be made to do and have another function, you know? And of course this is purely speculative. And
what kind of function could that be? What, can you give an example of this?
I mean, you can imagine all sorts of scenarios. So you're basically doing experiments on organisms. I mean, that's a sort of extreme case, but I had the feeling that the ethical rules had not been worked out. You know, people were just doing anything they felt like.
Before we meet one of the scientists who are developing gene editing methods based on CRISPR, we'll get back to Su Peng to understand how CRISPR-Cas systems can be applied in human cells.
Because bacteria and human cells, we have different machinery for all the cellular activities. We will need to edit the CRISPR-Cas system so that it can be expressed in human. So this is the first step. This has already been established back in 2012, 2013. And when this CRISPR-Cas is expressed in human cells, and scientists can engineer or design the so-called CRISPR RNA that we just mentioned, so that's the memory. So we will provide a CRISPR RNA sequence in the human, so the CRISPR-Cas will recognize the sequence in the human genome, and then we'll cut. And this cut will then lead to repair, and then this is the genome editing process. Yeah.
So you cut it out and then you put in a new piece.
Piece, yes. Once you generate a cut, then the human cell, they will monitor this. So there's a cut, I need to repair, because I need to link it again. If it will need a template, it will then link or repair the cut site exactly as the template sequence that you provide.
How can we control it that it's doing what we want to? It's not manipulating with other parts of our genes.
Exactly. This is an excellent question, because the human genome is huge. So there is a very high chance when you want to target a particular place, there are other places in the human DNA that have similar sequences. CRISPR-Cas9 then might also target those unwanted sites, and we need to avoid this. But this has been worked, I think almost worked out, because scientists have been continuously improving CRISPR-Cas9 system so that it won't target other sites.
When you want to change the human DNA, there is also some ethical dilemmas involved.
Yes.
Can you describe some of those dilemmas that the scientists
Yeah, exactly. So on one hand, CRISPR-Cas9 has one, I mean, very high potential for medical applications to human beings. On the other hand, especially for genetic disease, how are we going to use it? I think there is a bottom line that we should always hold. So we should never cross this bottom line. So it's like that, so we should never modify DNA sequence of human germline cells. Because if you modify DNA information there, it will be inherited. It will be transferred, so the modifications will be transferred to next generations. And we don't know the consequence to the particular, you know, to the specific person, and we don't know this to the population in the far future. I think most scientists think in my way, but there might be other opinions. So I think it's important for the future medical application of CRISPR-Cas9 in human beings, it's very important that we should have a regulatory authority to monitor, to approve the application. Of course, this regulatory authority should also involve scientists.
The next person we meet is Professor Guglielmo Montoya. He is the research director and group leader at the Protein Structure and Function Group at Novo Nordisk Foundation Center for Protein Research at the University of Copenhagen. He is developing ways to use CRISPR as a gene editing tool, and he is much more optimistic about the prospects of the science in order to cure diseases which are impossible to cure today.
I mean, we arrived to CRISPR from genome editing, because we were working, we have been working in genome editing for a very long time, since 2003 or 2004. We started to work on CRISPR because we are interested on the tools that are used for genome editing, because this protein scaffold is very appropriate to work with. To use it as molecular scissors for genome editing.
What is it that you're exactly working on right now?
Our work is very basic, because we try to see how these proteins work, and basically through understanding how they work at atomic level, then we try to understand how, when they have mutations or they don't work properly, they promote disease or failures in the cell.
And what kind of applications do you think we'll see in the future?
Oh, I think it's coming at the moment. There are plenty of clinical trials at the moment, and I think in the future we will see it has already happened with some patients that the appropriate, for example, leukemias and lymphomas might be cured by genome editing. And this has been already tested in certain cases. CRISPR-Cas and other genome editing tools have had a key role in developing the CAR T therapies by editing the cells that are attacking the tumor in immune oncology. All these applications that can be done ex vivo, where you extract cells from the patient, do the correction in the lab, and then reimplant the cells in the patient. I think this is gonna happen in really short time. Yeah, those that you will need to put the tool directly in the organism, this is going to be more difficult.
You don't fear that this kind of gene therapy also can cause some side effects that can be...
When gene therapy was used in like 20 or 30 years ago, there were some problems with some clinical trials in France where some kids were treated and they developed cancer. But this, the problem is that the technology they were using is based on vectors which integrate randomly. The advantage of genome editing is that you are supposed to go precise to the place where the mutation or the place that you want to edit and perform the cut. This is what we are working on, to improve the tools so that they do not cut randomly and the repair is done properly.
And you think it's possible to make it precise enough?
At the moment, for ex vivo applications, it's not really still a work, but because of the power of new technologies like next-generation sequences, this is possible because you can select many clones, and some of the clones will, one of the clones, even the percentage is, I think, around 1 to 3% are correct. You are able to select those for reimplantation, so there is no risk there. So in applications where you have to try the whole organism, that may be a problem if you have a tool that is not so precise or you do not transfect all the cells properly. But the main point is that many of those diseases, they have no cure right now. So, yeah.
This is an opportunity to actually cure some of the diseases.
Yeah,
but this kind of technology can be, once it's developed and for the good purpose, it can also,
guess,
be
happens.
Used in a lot of bad ways, technology.
This happens always in science. It is up to the society how they want to employ this technology. I mean, the advantage of CRISPR is that the easiness to do the editing, because with the previous tools that we had before, it was very difficult to modify the tool to select the sequence that you want to target. While with CRISPR, this is very easy. You just change one of the components, the RNA, and then you target a different site. But going back to your question, I think that the problem is that CRISPR is a kind of evolution accelerator. So you have evolution in evolution. Basically, this is the process that we have, is that the species are improving or adapting to the environment. And here you can do it much faster because you have a tool to do the editing yourself. It's like going from writing by hand to the print, basically. And that may be problems when you want to print things that might be ethically not so clear.
So what kind of things could that be?
Well, in principle, I think we are a bit far off trying to create like superhumans or things like that. And I think we are far because even though we are advancing a lot in our knowledge, there is many of these traits, like intelligence and strength, and it's a combination of different genes, you know. And sometimes we do not know if by pushing some keys we are altering others. People might try to do that, but it's a little bit crazy because you do not know what's going to happen, because you do not have all the variables that are being influenced by altering certain things.
Yeah. So what would be your recommendations for the society and the politicians to control?
So there is already some initiatives to basically have a kind of a general or worldwide treaty to decide which things can be done or which things cannot be done. There are some outliers, I would say, like this Chinese scientist, which is, as far as I know, is in jail at his place. And there is also one group in Moscow that are trying to do genome editing in embryos. And the problem is that if you do genome editing in embryos, basically you are altering the species, because as this go in something that we call the germinal line, it will be transferred to the offspring, and there must be some limits to this type of research.
Though the different scientists have different points of view when it comes to how much CRISPR can be applied successfully in gene editing, they are still complementing each other. One of the challenges about using CRISPR-Cas systems in gene manipulation is to control that it only cuts out the unwanted gene and that it cuts precisely. Su Peng discovered in her lab that not only does bacteria defend itself against viruses with a CRISPR-Cas defense mechanism, but the viruses hits back with an anti-CRISPR.
We know like 40% of our bacteria and almost all archaea, they have CRISPR-Cas system. The question then arose, why there are still so abundant viruses found in nature? You know, there are 10 times or 100 times more virus than the host in nature. So viruses must have evolved different ways of counteracting the defense mechanism. So one of the ways is anti-CRISPR. Anti-CRISPR proteins, they are small proteins, generally speaking, encoded by the viruses. They can specifically inhibit a particular type of CRISPR-Cas. And one exciting aspect of this is, if you remember, we talked about off-targeting of CRISPR-Cas. So if you want to cut one site in a human genome, it might cut another site. And this off-targeting activity is partially derived from the constant activity of CRISPR-Cas9, or too strong activity of CRISPR-Cas9. So if we can modulate, if we can control CRISPR-Cas system, for example, by anti-CRISPR proteins, then we can improve the off-targeting issue.
We are in Su Peng's lab in the BioCenter at the University of Copenhagen. And it looks like any other bio lab. But this is where the newest science within CRISPR is going on.
So we do a lot of cloning, so DNA cloning, so we can engineer CRISPR system and also engineer viral genomes so that we can see, we can analyze the phenotypes of genome editing. So the model, we use a model system, it's called a Cephalobus, that's a thermophilic archaea isolated from hot springs. And the reason for us to use this model system is because it has four different CRISPR-Cas systems in a single cell. So this gives us a very good opportunity to study, you know, the different systems, why a single cell should have different systems, what is the evolutionary implication of this.
So far, we've been focusing on CRISPR-Cas systems, which can be used for gene manipulation. But this is only one kind of CRISPR-Cas system, and only one potential way to apply CRISPR-Cas systems. There are 6 different kinds of CRISPRs, and the science can be applied in many other ways. For example, it's possible to tell which kind of viruses attack the bacteria in our gut, which is rather useful knowledge. We'll get back to how and why later. In the following, we'll explore these other dimensions of CRISPR, which is more a celebration of the beautiful and highly intelligent nature. It's about the interaction between bacteria and viruses, and the complexity of the immune systems bacteria and archaea has evolved. And those microorganisms are crucial to our organism and to the whole global ecosystem.
Bacteria are very simple organisms. Many of the interactions that happen between them and viruses and other bacteria are like insanely complex, and we're only beginning to understand that now.
This is Siraj Shah, senior scientist at Gentofte Hospital.
And so many of these interactions that between different bacteria, they actually drive many of the global biochemical cycles and stuff. You know, a lot of climate change, nitrogen cycling, carbon cycling, all this stuff has a lot to do with how bacteria interact with each other. So they're actually very crucial to our survival. If bacteria did not exist, then other life would basically not exist.
Siraj Shah was taken into the whole CRISPR research by Roger Garrett.
And so he was trying to understand these CRISPR-Cas systems, and then he got a lot of money. And for that money, he hired me. And I didn't know that much about CRISPR-Cas systems back when I started. But the day that I started, Roger gave me an introduction. And I was like completely mind blown. You know, I couldn't understand how can you have such a complex immune system actually in cells, in single-celled organisms, right? I mean, we have immune systems, you and I, that also protect us against viruses and stuff. But our immune systems are like made up of different, like maybe 100 different cell types in our bodies, different kinds of cells working together, doing different stuff to pull off our immune reaction. And here you just have one cell and just a few genes, maybe like 10 or 20 genes encoding some proteins that basically drive the whole immune response inside that cell. And it's also an adaptive immune response, just like our immune response. So basically it learns from the infections that you get in order to combat future infections. So our immune system does that. The immune system of bacteria and archaea, the CRISPR immune system does that as well. So I was like completely mind blown that you can even have that in like a bacterial or an archaeal cell. I think CRISPR-Cas has in a lot of way revived microbiology, because microbiology was becoming kind of boring. People had kind of gotten over bacteria because they were quite simple and they were useful to understand systems at a very basic level. But then there was a need to also understand more complex systems. So people were actually kind of leaving bacteria behind in the early 2000s. And so then CRISPR came along and it basically revived the whole field of microbiology.
From CRISPR research at the University of Copenhagen, Siraj Shah went to do research about asthma in children at Gentofte Hospital. You might wonder what asthma research has to do with CRISPR, but it has actually quite a lot to do with it.
Their mothers were recruited to the study before the children were even born, and we've been following them since they were born. And what I mean by following is that we collect all kinds of data on these children. So basically we take blood tests and measure all kinds of, you know, levels of different chemicals in their blood. We look at different data from their home, you know, how is their environment at home, where do they live, what age did they start daycare, when did they start going to school? How many friends do they have? You know, what interactions do they have with other kids and siblings and stuff like that? And apart from that, we also have a lot of data on, you know, we've taken samples, maybe like fecal samples, like you know, samples of poo. So we know which bacteria they have in their stomachs at different time points, you know, at 1 week of age, 1 month of age, 1 year of age, like 4 years of age, 6 years of age, etc. And so we also have samples of the bacteria in their guts and in their airways and on their skin, dust samples from their home. We're trying to figure out everything that we can about the lives of these children. And the reason for this is that, you know, most people today, they die of chronic disease. Chronic disease is stuff like cancer, stuff like heart disease, stuff like diabetes, causes most deaths in the world, like 80% of all deaths, I think. And we're trying to figure out what is kind of the link between some of these early life factors and different chronic diseases. Because to this day, we still actually don't know why chronic diseases occur. I mean, we see that there are some associations with a bad lifestyle, Western lifestyle diet, no exercise, stuff like that. But even then, you see people who you know, do exercise a lot and do have a healthy lifestyle, some of them still get cancer and stuff like that. So we don't actually know why chronic diseases occur. And we're trying to see whether we can find, you know, things that we can measure in the kids' lives early in life that end up predicting chronic disease later in life. And we found a number of things that already do this, which is really interesting. For example, kids who have pets from a very young age, they have less of a risk of developing asthma by age 5 and stuff like that. So there are lots of different things in the data that we can see. And some of the data that we have on these children is the viruses that were present in the gut at age 1. And that's the data set that I'm looking at. We have like 16,700 viruses that we have measurements of in the guts of these children at age 1. So for each kid, we can see, okay, kid number 1 has so many of virus number 1. He has so many of virus number 2, so many of virus number 3, all the way down to like virus number 16,000. Kid number 2 has so many of virus number 1, virus number 2, et cetera, et cetera. So we can take those numbers of viruses for each kid and we can compare that to, you know, the different, you know, the diagnoses that the kid might end up getting, or stuff like obesity or ADHD or, you know, stuff like that, to try to see, is there a connection between the viruses that the kid has and the different diagnoses that the kid gets. And so one of the things that came out of this study is that most viruses in the gut at age 1 are not human viruses. They're viruses that infect the different bacteria that are present in the gut, right? And so we know that there are all of these viruses in the gut. We need to make the link between the different viruses in the gut and the different bacteria that they infect. How do we make that link? Well, one way to make that link is basically looking at the CRISPR-Cas system that the bacteria are using to protect themselves against those same viral infections. So we can go into the bacteria and we can read the area on the genome that encodes for the CRISPR-Cas system. And by looking at that, we can see this bacterium is trying to protect itself against that, and that virus. This bacterium is trying to protect itself against that, and that virus, etc. So we can actually make links between the different viruses. So now we know which of the 16,000 viruses infect which of the 300 different bacteria that are present in the gut using CRISPR.
So by using its CRISPR-Cas systems, the bacteria creates a library in its own genome with sequences of DNA of all the viruses it's been attacked by. And it is therefore possible to get a full picture of which viruses are attacking the bacteria in our gut, which is shown to have an influence on our immune system. Bacteria and viruses, which has been seen as an enemy, is shown to be our best friend in many ways. In general, to have a diversity of those in our bodies is seen to have a positive effect on our immune system. And the knowledge of CRISPR-Cas system is a tool to get a deeper understanding of the complex relation between the bacteria and viruses we are hosting, our immune system, and maybe even our behavior.
People who are associated with lots and lots of diverse bacteria on their bodies, etc., they are more protected from chronic disease, right? So there's kind of a paradigm shift within microbiology at the moment where people are starting to view bacteria, instead of viewing them as bad guys, they're starting to view them as good guys. This is really interesting. This is kind of a big deal because we've had the complete opposite view of bacteria for the past 100 years. And so now that's changing, right? And so then my question is here, with the research that I'm doing, what if the same thing applies for viruses, right? I mean, especially now with this COVID pandemic, there's kind of a prevailing view that viruses are bad, they make us sick, right? But what if most viruses are actually good for us? And what if the more viruses you have in and on your body, the more protected you are long-term for different kinds of chronic disease? And so what we're seeing, at least, is that these children, they have like 16,000 different viruses, right? And most of these children are completely healthy. They don't have any illnesses, yet they're full of viruses. And so then people could say, okay, well, most of those viruses infect the bacteria in the gut. They don't actually infect the children themselves. So why would the children become sick of bacteria that infect, or become sick of viruses that infect the bacteria? And that's true. 90% of the viruses that we see in the guts of these children are bacterial viruses. But then we have like 10% of the data set, which are human viruses. And 10% of 16,000, that's still a lot of viruses. So we have like around maybe 1,000 viruses in the guts of these children that are human viruses that infect the actual human cells in the gut, but that don't make these children sick. And so, you know, I can imagine that if we start looking at these viruses and comparing them against different chronic diseases that the children develop later on in life, that we're going to start seeing patterns. And what I hope to see is that children with more viruses are more protected from disease. If we find that, that's going to be a big deal. You know, that's going to be kind of like a major deal, because that's going to prove that viruses can actually be good for us, or probably most viruses are good for us. And it's only like few viruses that are really bad for us that make us sick, but those are the only ones that we've been focusing on since, you know, since the beginning of virology. We've only been focusing on the viruses that make us sick. And we haven't been able to see, the viruses that are good for us have been completely invisible to us. Now we have the technology to actually go in and sequence all viruses, not only the bad ones. And so my hope is that we can start to see these things.
As mentioned before, there are many different kinds of CRISPR-Cas systems, which potentially can be of great advantages for humanity. In the following, Shiraz Shah will explain what those other CRISPR-Cas systems are capable of. And to those of you who are still listening, and therefore must be interested in more than just common CRISPR knowledge, it is getting really interesting, so stay tuned.
As we know, bacteria have been on Earth for 4 billion years, right? Way more than us. We've only been here, a few million years. You know, then you can imagine that if you think about bacteria having been there for 4 billion years and having had their immune systems, of course, their immune systems have had a lot more time to diverge into different versions of immune systems than ours. And even ours are diverse, so theirs are going to be even more diverse, right? And so you can divide the immune systems into two major classes, like class 1 systems and class 2 systems. Class 2 systems are the ones that are being used right now in biotechnology for genome engineering in human beings or in animals or in, you know, eukaryotic cells and stuff like that. We're using them as a technology for changing DNA. And I think the main reason for that is that class 2 systems are quite simple. And so if we look at the distribution of class 1 systems versus class 2 systems in nature and the bacteria that are using them to fight viruses, class 1 systems are way more common. So yeah, we're using class 2 systems for genome engineering in eukaryotes, that's true, because they're easy to work with. But it's like if you go out into nature, it seems that nature has chosen primarily class 1 systems, probably because they're more versatile, more efficient in one way or the other, right? Class 1 systems have not been adapted yet to use in genome engineering because they're so complicated, right? But would they be interesting and would they be useful? And so our research has focused on understanding class 1 systems and how class 1 systems work.
So we have CRISPR number 2, which is the one which is easy to use as gene scissors, and which is in family with number 5 and 6. And then there is number 1, 3 and 4, which is much more complicated. One of the reasons is that they're constructed in a modular way, where the CRISPR-Cas is divided in two different complexes, an adaptation complex for sampling and remembering the virus, and an interference complex which hunts down and kills the virus. And they can swap these two different parts with one another.
So the bacterium 1 can say, I have this interference complex and this adaptation complex, and you have this interference complex and this adaptation complex, let's swap it over. So they can swap both the adaptation and interference complex with each other, or they can choose to only swap half of the system with each other, right? And so what that reminds you of, actually, which is really interesting, I think, is that it's like CRISPR-Cas systems are like, quote-unquote, having sex, because that's what sex is. If you look at what sex is from a biological point of view, from an evolutionary point of view, what's going on is actually that, you know, evolution in an organism can happen in different ways. Mutation is often, you know, said to be a major, you know, mechanism by which evolution occurs. So you will have one organism which will gain a mutation in a gene that encodes for a protein, then that protein will function slightly differently. In most cases, the mutation is going to destroy the protein, but in a few cases, the mutation is going to be beneficial, maybe in that particular environment. And so that's going to confer a selective advantage to that particular organism. It can be a bacterium or an animal or whatever. And so then that mutation becomes more and more widespread in nature, and then you have a new variant of this gene or protein or whatever, right? But actually today, most evolution doesn't happen through mutation of proteins or mutation of individual genes. Most evolution today happens by mechanisms that look a lot like sex. With sex, basically, you have two different organisms, and they're basically saying, okay, give me that piece of DNA, I'll give you this instead. The advantage of doing it that way is basically that you don't have to go through the detrimental step of mutation. Because if you mutate your gene, there's a big chance that the gene is going to not work anymore, because most mutations are deleterious or they're destructive in one way or another. Now, if you have two different organisms that both have a working copy, but two different versions of the gene that both work, then they can swap them with each other. And so when one organism gets another version of a gene from another organism, then that new version of a gene might give it a new advantage that the other organism didn't have, because that gene is going to interact with different versions of other genes that that organism has, right? So basically what you can imagine, I know it gets a little bit complicated, but what you can imagine is with these CRISPR-Cas systems, you can imagine that, you know, a particular adaptation module and a particular interference module combination might work really well against some viruses, but not as good against other viruses, right? But what you can also imagine is that if you swap out just the interference module or just the adaptation module, then you're going to get, again, a completely new kind of profile of pros and cons for that particular combination of CRISPR-Cas systems. And that's basically what sex is. That's what we're seeing with eukaryotic organisms that can have sex, is that we're basically just recombining our genome. Instead of mutating it, we're just creating new combinations, which seems to work as well when trying to adapt to an environment than just mutating everything from scratch.
How is this knowledge interesting for science? How can this be useful in developing gene manipulation tools in the future? Or is this just interesting because it's a crazy system that the bacteria has developed?
Yeah, it's a really good question that I ask myself often. I have to be honest, sometimes like being a scientist is like it's like kind of trippy in a way. So it's like you're on a trip, because you sometimes discover things, you find things that are just too crazy. And it's like, what? You know, how did that even occur? This is just a CRISPR-Cas system, which is just an immune system in a bacterium. Why in the world is it, quote unquote, having sex with other CRISPR-Cas systems? You know, it just seems really, really crazy, right? And so I think the reason why they're probably pressured and then driven to go through these very extreme measures is to solve some kind of a problem in nature. And we have to try to figure out, okay, what problem is this mechanism trying to solve? Then we can use that mechanism for our own purposes, right? I've already talked about type 1 systems, and so with type 3 systems, they're modular in a way that I'm sure that we can use in biotech. The type 3 system has a lot of other tricks up its sleeve, which is quite cool. It's kind of like if you have a laptop. So the type 3 system is a laptop, right? And then you have these USB devices that you can stick into the laptop and upgrade the functionality of the laptop, either by having a webcam or like a USB storage thing, or maybe a, you know, all kinds of stuff that you can stick into the laptop. So you have the laptop, which is carrying out your core functionality, which always works, but then you can upgrade the laptop by adding new USB things in there, and those will like temporarily provide an additional function to your laptop, but then you can take it out again and the laptop will still be working and you can swap it out for another USB device. It kind of seems like that, you know, if I have to make an analogy. And I think that this can be used, as to your initial question, I think this could really be used in biotech. Why? Because what we're seeing today is that people are engineering class 2 systems to do other stuff than killing viruses. And so type 2 systems were initially antiviral immune systems in bacteria. Then we took it out and we put them into eukaryotic cells in order to make changes in the DNA of eukaryotes as kind of an application, right? So from something that was an immune system in a bacterium made for one particular purpose, we're now engineering this protein in different ways to use it for all kinds of different other purposes, right? And so my point is this, with type 3 systems, you have a system which is from the bottom, it's already designed for multifunctionality because you can have these USB devices plugging in and out of it, right? So it's already designed from the bottom up, it's already designed for multifunctionality. So imagine what happens when you get engineers and scientists, when they get their hands on these type 3 systems and can use them for technology, how they would be able to, you know, play with the function of this in all kinds of new ways. So I think that type 3 systems, once they do get adapted to genome engineering, they're going to be a lot more versatile than type 2 systems are.
You also talked about the type 4 systems.
Yeah, type 4 systems.
What can they do? What's special about them?
Type 4 systems are really cool. I mean, this is something new that we... This is some research that we've just done in collaboration, again, with Copenhagen University. And so the first author on this paper was a guy called Rafa, who was at Copenhagen University. He was the first author. Rafa, he came to me and he said, Shiraz, we have to try to look for CRISPR-Cas systems on plasmids. Most people probably don't know what plasmids are, so let me just try to explain that quickly. So a plasmid is basically a piece of DNA that is often found in bacteria. So the bacteria will have its own DNA, which is a giant piece of DNA. Then you have plasmids, which are these additional small circular DNA, and they can like upgrade the functionality of the bacterium in one way or another. Plasmids might encode genes for antibiotic resistance. So if a bacterium has a particular plasmid, then it will not be susceptible to antibiotics, for example. You can also have plasmids that encode virulence factors, so plasmids that allow the bacterium to become, to make us sick. This is what we see with a lot of bacteria that are able to infect us and make us sick, is that their virulence is encoded on a plasmid. So normally the bacterium would have no interest in making us sick, but because there's a plasmid inside the bacterium along with the main chromosome, it encodes the genes that are responsible for making that bacterium harm us. Plasmids can do all kinds of things, and plasmids can also be sometimes like a real headache for the bacterium because they spread in a population kind of like a virus, right? And so you can have a plasmid which is like just thinking about how can it spread to the next bacterium, and it doesn't really care about its bacterial host, so it will make the bacterium stick onto other bacteria so that a lot of bacteria get really close to each other so that it can transfer between different bacteria and stuff. They can kind of make their host bacteria kind of handicapped in a lot of ways and stuff like that. So we see bacteria trying to sometimes fight plasmids using their CRISPR-Cas system, because the CRISPR-Cas system can be used to fight viruses, but it can also be used to fight plasmids, because sometimes the bacteria just don't want the plasmids. It's too big a headache to have them. So then Rafa said, Shiraz, we need to look for CRISPR-Cas systems on plasmids. And I'm like, what? Why do you want to look for CRISPR-Cas systems on plasmids? Plasmids are being attacked by the CRISPR-Cas systems of their hosts. So why would plasmids have CRISPR-Cas systems? So I'm like, no, that's a bad idea. Anyway, so he started doing it, you know. And so what he found was that there are, in fact, lots of CRISPR-Cas systems on plasmids for some reason. So, like, plasmids have an immune system against what? Becomes then the next question. We don't really know what that is, what that immune system is against. And what we found is that mainly the type of immune system that you found in on plasmids are these type 4 systems. But now Rafa, he looked at these plasmids and he found like loads and loads of type 4 systems. And he's like, Shiraz, this is like a plasmid-specific CRISPR-Cas system. This is like an immune system that the plasmids have to, you know, take care of their own interests in one way or another. And I'm like, what? That doesn't make sense. Why the hell would plasmids have their own immune system? And so then we ask, okay, what are they trying to kill? Because we can go into the CRISPR locus and we can see what kind of DNA is the plasmid trying to protect itself against, because it has been inserted as spacers inside the CRISPR locus. And so if you look at the spacers inside the CRISPR locus on a plasmid adjacent to a type 4 system, what you see that most of those spacers are targeting other plasmids. So the thing that the plasmid is trying to defend itself against is basically other plasmids. So it seems that plasmids have an interest when they're inside a bacterium. It seems that they have an interest in trying to monopolize that bacterium so that other plasmids can't get in. One of the ways they do that is by having a type 4 CRISPR-Cas system that will attack another plasmid as soon as it tries to get in and tries to gain control over the bacterium. So it kind of, you know, it paints a picture of these plasmids as being these really like sinister, you know, things that are waging war against each other. And it was just, yeah, it was just really cool when you think about it. In a way, you know, plasmids are doing kind of what we're doing with the CRISPR-Cas system. We're taking type 2 CRISPR-Cas systems and we're using them for genome engineering. We're using them for our own purposes, right? And so it seems that plasmids have done this way before human beings. They've taken a CRISPR-Cas system and they're using it for their own purpose to fight other plasmids.
That's crazy. That's really crazy.
It is crazy.
It's so advanced.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's so funny. So weird. There's so much trippy shit, you know, when you're...
So they take the Cas system from the bacteria and use it for their own...
Yeah, for themselves.
Okay.
Yeah, for themselves. And the way that they use it for their own purpose is because they're interested in keeping that bacterium for themselves. In order to keep that bacterium for themselves, they have to fight any other plasmid that gets in.
And do you think we could use that knowledge in the future?
Yes, I think we can. Probably, I think there are lots of ways. I remember Rafa talking about it. He had a list of different ideas. If plasmids know how to use, you know, plasmids don't even have a brain, right? If plasmids know how to use a CRISPR-Cas system for their own advantage, then obviously there are going to be a lot more different things that we can do with that same CRISPR-Cas system. And some of the things that come to mind is basically, you know, antibiotic resistance is a major problem, right? Antibiotic resistance. And antibiotic resistance, you know, has been projected by the United Nations by 2050 to be causing the most deaths in the world and all kinds of stuff like, right? So it's like a major problem out there waiting for us, just like climate change. It's something that's going to really mess shit up for us as human beings. And so since we know that, you know, most of the antibiotic resistance that goes on in bacteria and that is transferred between bacteria is transferred with plasmids, right? Then maybe if plasmids can use, you know, type 4 systems to, you know, wage war against each other, maybe we can also use type 4 systems to wage equal war against them. And in that way, we can maybe wage war against antibiotic resistance. That's what I hope. That's what I'm crossing my fingers for.
Science has just begun to understand the complexity of some of those CRISPR-Cas systems and the possibilities of how this knowledge can and will change the future of the human species. It's both unpredictable and full of hopes and dreams, dangers and fears. One thing that has been mentioned by all the scientists I talked to make this episode is the importance of ethical guidelines and an improved understanding of the CRISPR-Cas systems. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Science and Cocktails podcast, which is funded by the Novo Nordisk Foundation and produced by me, Sophie Hjort, for the Science and Cocktails Foundation. The music is originally composed for this episode by Hjalte Bisted Møller, also known as Trommelorkestret. Find future episodes on scienceandcocktails.org.